Irish food and agri-businesses. They're bracing themselves. That's for the impact of a year-long recession in Britain. It represents 30% of Irish food and agri-businesses' export market. And Gerard Brady, the chief economist with IBEC, does join me this afternoon to discuss. How are you, Gerard?
Hi, good evening.
So it's the bleakest assessment it's been noted as here for over a decade. The Bank of England not only warned the downturn there will last a year, but that inflation will spike there to over 13% in the coming months. At the moment here in Ireland, it's around between 9 to 9.3% at the moment. So we really feel it here. I think most people couldn't even imagine it going up to 13%.
Yeah, I think it's very bleak, the forecasts from the Bank of England. So they still are forecasts, I suppose, but the Bank of England, you know, are in charge of trying to control inflation and understand it. So it's forecasts from a pretty reputable organisation. They're probably saying three things. One is that we're going to have 13% inflation, or the UK will have 13% inflation towards the end of this year. But not just that, but that inflation, or high inflation at least, over 5, 6, 7% will carry on throughout most of next year as well, that they expect inflation won't come down as quickly as they might have before.
So is 13 the ceiling for inflation over in Britain?
Yeah, 13 is the peak that they expect towards this winter, but they do expect that to continue through. And they're also saying that not just is there going to be a recession from more or less this winter through most of 2023, but that growth won't, or any material growth won't return to the economy in the UK until at least 2025. So it's a long, long period of kind of economic recession or close to recession in the UK predicted by the Bank of England.
So, Gerard, we know we're in a cost of living crisis. You know, external things like the situation in Ukraine, the invasion by Russia in Ukraine has impacted things like grain. We're just seeing in the past few hours that the first shipment of grain from Ukraine will reach Ireland in the next few days. But if we look at Britain, obviously they went through a lot before any pandemic was declared, Brexit. So can people assume some of this inflation and issues they may have been caused by earlier impacts, not just what's happened in the past couple of years and then the past 6 months with the invasion?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in the UK economy, I suppose, that when we've talked to members over the last number of days, this is a key point, that the difference between Ireland and the UK, why we might have a slightly brighter outlook, even though things are very difficult at the moment, is firstly because the UK, since more or less the financial crisis, has not seen huge growth in the economy. So just for example, if you take wages and adjust for inflation, they haven't seen any growth for over a decade, whereas we've seen consistent kind of 2-3% growth in wages.
So explain to me,
Gerard,
explain to me why there's the difference there. Why did we see growth and they didn't see the same level of growth?
It's due to a couple of things. One is our economic openness. So we've continued to have strong multinational investment. A lot of our domestic sectors have continued to export and grow. And the UK, a lot of their main sectors outside the City of London have struggled for quite a long time. And the second impact is the one that, you know, most people will be sick of hearing about. But Brexit has had a really significant impact on both investment by companies who just aren't as confident about the future in the UK. And we've also seen their exports slow because the UK, their biggest market was the EU. That relationship has obviously broken down. So for other countries, for Ireland selling into the UK, they aren't as big a market as they once were. For the UK, the EU was still a massive market. So between slowing exports and slowing investment, they were already in a tricky spot economically coming into the crisis, which, as you say, has really taken off in the last number of months.
And you have said that despite the UK diversifying, it still represents about 30% of the export market. That's for indigenous firms. And that those small exporting companies are, in quote from you, jobs rich, and they've spread employment across the four corners of the country. The report obviously shows the challenges that face the small and medium enterprises out of Ireland selling into Britain. So they're going to be impacted. But can the general public be impacted by this also?
They can. I suppose, look, if you look at the sectors that are most exposed, the Irish economy as a whole, only about 10% of our exports now go to the UK, because a lot of our exports come from multinationals which go worldwide to the US, to Europe and elsewhere. But when you look at just SME exporters and indigenous exporters, so things like the agri-food sector, parts of manufacturing, engineering and some of those kind of sectors that are, you know, across local economies across the country, UK is still close to a third, a little less than 30% of the export base for those companies. And, you know, as they're affected, if there is a long period of protracted slowdown, there were already challenges with Brexit. You will see a challenge there for some of those companies to stay competitive, to grow export markets elsewhere in a kind of a challenging global environment. Doesn't mean they can't do it, but it would, if there was a slowdown for those companies in their exports, obviously have a knock-on impact on suppliers, on customers, on employees across the country. And just to put it in context, I suppose, those indigenous exporters and SME exporters spend as much in the Irish economy in wages, in purchases from suppliers, in contracts with companies in their locality, as the whole multinational sector does. So the kind of multiplier back into the economy from that sector is really important, particularly in the regions outside Dublin and in rural areas.
Now, here the Taoiseach did say the positive exchequer figures, which were announced earlier this week, are allowing the government to do more to help Irish households deal with the cost of living crisis. And I mention that because you noted, you know, the UK didn't bounce back in terms of worldwide recession, but wages are something that the majority of people in this country at the moment are struggling with. They're struggling to make ends meet, yet financially and economically, this country is successful. That may be worrying to some people because they're not actually seeing it in their own personal situations.
Yeah, I suppose we've seen improvements for households in a number of ways. Look, so firstly, we've seen about 200,000 people additional versus 2019 in employment. So obviously, for a lot of households who have more people working, it's better than the alternative in terms of their incomes. And the second thing we've seen is the growth in wages. So overall wages in the economy now are, and we can see it in the income tax returns, the income tax take is about 30% higher in the first 6 months of this year versus the first 6 months of 2019.
But Jerry, does that not just mean...
It's because people are earning more.
But does that not just mean that there's a certain small cohort, the 1%, earning a lot more?
No, it's fairly broad, right? So you wouldn't see a 30% increase in tax receipts, income tax receipts, on the back of only a very small number of people getting pay increases. There have been pay increases across lots of sectors. But on the other hand, look, the big challenge is going to be inflation. It's probably not just an issue in the workplace in terms of wages, but there needs to be targeted support from government. And they've set out that, you know, they have almost 7 billion coming in the budget, which is now going to be in late September. It's important that gets targeted at people who need it the most, because we have seen this kind of divergence between households. Some households have seen really significant savings and have built up buffers through COVID, which means they won't be hit as hard by the increased inflation or can deal with it better. But others haven't got those buffers, haven't got those savings, and will need support from the government.
And as Gerard noted, the Bank of England report predicted UK inflation will stay elevated and the downturn in the economy will extend through next year and 2024, looking around summer 2025. Is that what you noted there, Gerard?
Yeah, so they are like the main and probably the part that kind of surprised most people, and it wasn't that there was a downturn or wasn't that there was a slowdown in the UK economy. I think most people expected that. But the fact that the Bank of England are now saying it will be at least 2025, that we'll have to wait until we see growth again in the UK. And that is a challenge. Look, for the UK economy, it's very bleak. We probably, and in our forecasts and most forecasts in Ireland, we still see the economy growing, albeit at a much slower pace over the coming years. So it still provides us with some opportunities that they won't have in the UK.
Okay, and then again, the outlook of the from the Bank of England report is it's based on average energy bills increasing there by 75%. That's to approximately £3,500, which would be about €4,150. That's at the moment anyway in October. Listen, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. That is Chief Economist with IBEC, Gerard Brady. Now, there have been calls on the government to cut excise duty on alcohol. That is to help pubs deal with the rising costs that everybody is dealing with. As we noted, UK in a bad situation in terms of recession, potentially until summer 2025. But here, there has been a sharp decline in the number of pubs in Ireland. That's over the past 16 years. And I am joined now to discuss this by Declan Kennedy of Brady's Clockhouse in Maynooth and also the chairman of the Kildare Vintners. How are you, Declan?
Not too bad. How are you?
I am good. Thank you very much. The report that was released yesterday by the Drinks Industry Group of Ireland, 21% decline in the number of Irish pubs since 2005. Yes. Your take on that, was that surprising at all?
It always comes as a surprise or a shock, I suppose. But part of that reason is people that are retiring probably from the business and looking to probably finding that they're property is worth more as house or as something else, or as development. And partly to a customer, the habits of customers have seriously changed in the last couple of years with COVID. And also, our biggest problem is the drink driving. We need to have taxis and more of it, taxis available in rural Ireland. There is a scheme out there to help that, but we're finding that taximen are now being becoming auxiliary ambulances.
Okay, we'll get to the taxi issue in one moment, Declan. I want to ask you first, though, about the habits of people post-COVID in terms of their nightlife, I guess. What have you noticed?
We find that they're coming in early. We find that you could have, especially the younger people, there might be four or five of them sitting together. One will eat now, and then in another half hour, another might have a bite. They are all eating, but not as one, if you know what I mean. We do find that they are beginning to come back to the later bars. That is becoming a bit more, especially on a Saturday night, a bit more definitely at the start. It wasn't as strong, but the demand is back there for that. I will admit to that.
Now, I do just want to note before we get to the taxis that three counties show decreases, according to this Drinks Industry Ireland report, between 10 and 14.9%. And those three counties did include Carlow, our neighbours, another neighbour of Wicklow, and us here in County Kildare. So Carlow's numbers decreased by 10.4%, Kildare's numbers 13.6%, and Wicklow 10.1%. Kildare's lost 26 pubs since 2005. As a publican in the county,
and Leash lost 30%.
Well, I'm just about to get to some of the higher figures in a moment, but just yourself as a publican in the county, was this encouraging?
We owned some of them are in towns. They're not all rural pubs, by the way. People seem to perceive that they're all going to be out in the middle of the countryside. A lot of them have been in towns, and we have to ask. Maybe the day of sitting along the counters, I know one pub, and he that just doesn't work anymore. They want tables, groups of four and five and six, and some of the pubs just can't cater for that. It's one other pub, and I know they just want out, and I think that they'll probably sell the property on. There is an element of that, that people are just looking to retire out of the business. Another thing that must be said is that sometimes they're in some areas, there may be too many pubs. That's just a natural run of things. And unfortunately, we are in a period where people are exiting the trade.
You mentioned Leash there. They did see a decrease of 30.6%.
Yes.
Less pubs since 2005. It was the only county with a decrease of 30% or more. The lowest decrease, again, another neighbour of ours, Meath, 1.4% less. And then that just followed by Dublin. And Dublin saw a decrease of 4.3%. Why such a small decrease with the county of Meath?
Basically, I suppose the same with North Kildare and North Wicklow. It's bordering on the greater Dublin area, and it's the population that drives the demand. You look at parts of Meath, it's are within access of Dublin, and that does help your business. Not just the industry is basing around there, and all the new factories. That's another source of income for publicans, and that's, you know, the rural Dublin divide. That's when you clearly see it, and that may be broadening the train services down into the countryside and moving government buildings and that into the rural areas would help drive forward the smaller towns and up and down the Midlands of Ireland.
Now, the Drinks Industry Group Ireland's report, Associate Professor Emeritus of DCU, that's Anthony Foley, did give a quote about this, and he said, pubs serve as a vital social outlet for many people, particularly in rural Ireland. You've mentioned it a few times, and you've also touched on the taxis. Tell us more about what you would like to see done, or what you could see possibly be done by government or others as a publican in this county.
Like, I was looking at at one stage when we reopened, a lot of taxi men did not come back into the business. Now that's beginning to change.
You're speaking reopened post COVID-19 lockdowns, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. A lot of them did. And what a lot of them found was that when they went to renew their insurance, that was very expensive. That you're starting off as a newbie. And you know, if you cancel your car insurance or house insurance when you go back, it is very hard to get back onto the run of things. We would like to see a sort of a nighttime taxi service. You know, we're finding that there are
So just let me ask you there, Declan, you'd like to see that, but how can you see something like that be put in place? Because you want to obviously entice and encourage taxi drivers to work at those hours, and of course, that they feel safe.
That is, I agree 100% with that. 99% of people behave themselves. It's the 1% that cause a problem. We do know that the guards will respond fairly quickly to any incident. It's the follow-up of charging these people and getting them seriously punished, because it's not right that a person trying to make a living is endangered in any sense of the word, whether it's a taxi man or someone on a bus or someone in a supermarket. That, I think, that is not been underlined. No one doing their work, day's work, is entitled to be attacked or abused in any sort. And at the moment, there's a feeling that the courts aren't slapping down hard enough on that type of thing. And that's one thing that could help it. But I think that we definitely need to look. I was talking to one publican, he said the bus drives by him, stopped at his bus, at the bus stop outside his pub, and he said no one gets on and no one gets off at night. They use it during the daytime, and he it's not that there's trouble on the bus, he says it's just not perceived as being a form of transport, and that's a worry. You know, if you live down the road, the bus up and you can get the bus right back nearly to your house door. He just don't know what it seems to be, a shift of people's attitude to public transport that has to be definitely. We find that the younger people will use it.
And we can understand, I think, to a degree why some people are put off by public transport, obviously over the past 2.5 years with the self-isolation, the 2 metres, you know, all the rest. That makes sense to a degree. But obviously you pointed out a lot of other potential issues there. I want to go back to the call on the government to cut the excise duty on alcohol. That is to help the pubs deal with the rising prices. That would be reducing it by 7.5%. That's over the next 2 years to ease the cost burden. Yourself, the cost of running a business has, like, if you were to give me a percentage, how much has it increased by, I would say, for you?
It's gone up over 33% in the electricity. We have a kitchen here, as you know, and that is just driving it mad, because you have your refrigeration. The hot weather doesn't help matters either. We have the second highest tax on alcohol in Europe after Finland. It's very hard when people come back from abroad comparing prices, when we're saying, so they're not paying and the same level of taxation on the on drink. And that is very hard to compete about. And most pubs are paying their direct debit every month into the VAT man.
Have there been conversations with government officials about this? Because I'm sure some people would say about that 7.5%, you know, playing devil's advocate, what potential reasons would say that is because this country may have alcohol issues and trying to, I guess, stop people drinking so much.
I think that I understand that, and the minimum price of alcohol is a very helpful thing, because at the moment I can buy a product, I can't mention that we only discussed it, and it's 33% dearer for me to bring in down the supermarket. The same product in that bottle there for me is 33% dearer. That's a hard thing to take. I understand alcohol, but alcohol isn't the only drug that we have an issue with in this country. And it's at least taxed. It is controlled within the public house. I believe that going forward, they have to give pubs, breweries and distilleries a chance to survive. Taxing them out of existence does not help.
And Declan, you're
putting loads of people out on the dole in the long run.
And Declan, your personal bounce back in terms of the business, Brady's Clockhouse Maynooth, since the closures due to COVID-19, how has it been over the past, would say, six, seven months?
I have to say, it has been very, very good. I think people missed us, which is great to hear. Not just me, but they missed the pub atmosphere. They missed sitting down. I was actually talking to a woman there, and she was going to have a party. She said, during the lockdown, we had it in the house. She says, never again, she said, because the cleaning up afterwards. She said, I appreciate the pubs now better than ever, ever, ever. So in that sense, yes, we're most pubs are saying that.
So you're good at cleaning, Declan.
You have to be good at cleaning.
Good stuff.
You know, I always tell the young barman, I said, if I don't see a cloth in your hand, you're
breaking the male stereotype. I like it. Listen, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. That is Declan Kennedy. He is of Brady's Clockhouse in Maynooth. And of course, he's also the chairman of the Kildare Vintners. And we were speaking about the calls on the government to cut the excise duty on alcohol. That's to help with the pubs dealing with the rising costs. And also the number of pubs that have declined in the country by 21% since 2005. Over 1,800 pubs have closed in that 16-year period from 2005 until the end of 2021. And Michael O'Donovan is of the Vintners Federation of Ireland, and he has said that the publicans need help to survive this winter.
Over the last 20 years, we've seen a huge rise in the, drinking at home culture, which has been a big factor in it. Over the last number of years, we've just seen the perfect storm, and it's really affected the pub trade over that period.
Today, over 4,000 applicants are receiving CAO Round Zero offers. It's 4,027 to be precise. And Brian Mooney does join me now. He's education columnist with the Irish Times, and he is also a guidance counsellor. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm doing beautifully, Ciara, down here in gorgeous Lahinch, enjoying the sunshine.
I know, so it's good weather down west, is it?
Happy to talk to you about the offers.
Well, good stuff. I'm glad you joined me. But it's a good weather in the west of the country.
It's gorgeous now.
Okay,
today,
okay, good stuff. Hopefully it will come up this way, because it's not looking too great right now. It's been grand.
You're getting what we had last night, so don't worry, it's
okay.
On its way.
Okay, it's on its way. Good stuff. Right, so this round of offers, it's known as Round Zero. What is that?
Basically, people think of the CAO as just kids leaving school, whereas in fact it's people of all ages. So back in July, at the beginning of July, anybody who was over 23 who applied as an over 23-year-old known as a mature student, they got their offers. And that was based on interviews that they would had with them back in March and April to possibly see, you know, were they suitable for the course or assessment of what they did in during their life to date, etc. Today, it's mainly students who may have done the Leaving Cert last year or the year before, may have done a one-year PLC level 5 or a two-year level 6, have got a very good result and are now being offered places on those CAO programs that they may well not have had the points for last year, or they may have had and they may not have been sure whether it was the right course for them. But they are getting offers today based mainly on their further education results. There are another group of people in there. There are people who may have wanted to do medicine when they did the Leaving Cert 4 or 5 years ago, didn't get the points for it, didn't get the HPAT at the time. They did another degree, probably a science degree, maybe biomed or something, and they have applied to do medicine as the four-year postgrad program, mainly in UL in Limerick, but some in the other four medical schools. And they are getting their offers today. And there's a handful of maybe people from last month, issues that may have arisen. Somebody didn't get an offer for a reason, and maybe they're getting an offer today. But mainly, of those 3,346 students who are getting Level 8 offers, I think the vast majority of them will be people who will have done further education and PLC courses in the last 12 months.
So, round zero offers became available at 10 a.m. to view. When you do receive an offer in round zero, you must accept it by the 10th of August
at 3 p.m. Students get about a week. So in this case, it's the 10th of August at 3 p.m. And if you don't accept it by, and there's nothing coming in post anymore, it's all, you get a text or you get an email or whatever. So effectively, you go onto the CEO website and you go in there and you accept your place. If you don't...
You know when you say there's nothing coming by text, do you have to go in for by post. Do you have to go in for the Leaving Cert results still come by post, though, do they? Or that piece of paper?
The Leaving Cert results will come on the portal, but effectively you can pick them up in the school as well.
Yeah.
But the CAO are not communicating by written post anymore.
Okay.
The day in which the CAO sent out letters, they, you know, the vast majority of their paper is gone. They don't do handbooks anymore, other than maybe one for the guidance counsellor in the school, but the handbook is fully online in the digital format. They don't send out the letters in May anymore, which they used to send out, but it's all available online. So effectively, people need to know that you're not waiting for postal written communication from the CEO anymore. It'll all be on your own account, online, and you go in there. Now, they will send you notification electronically that it's there, but effectively, you've got to go in there and you accept your place electronically, and if you don't, it's gone at the end of the day.
Yeah, I know I could view my Leaving Cert results on the portal as well, actually. So now that I've said it, I'm like, yes, that's so obvious. But no, thank you for that. Brian, also just with this time of year, it's getting to grips with how to talk to students, no matter what age they are, about the exam results, whether good or bad. How can we do it?
Well, look, students will be getting the results now in, what, about 4 weeks, 2nd of September, Friday? Yeah, it's probably 4 weeks today. And, you know, when they get those results, they will have a range of options. Now, if some of them are disappointed, they don't get the result which will give them the CAO offer they were hoping from, which will be on the following Thursday, the 8th. Well, look at those who are getting the offers today through the PLCs. There are over 3,000 students very happy today who may well have been hundreds of points short. I was in contact with a family this morning where a student was hoping to get commerce in UCD, didn't get it last year, was devastated, started another course completely wrong for him. I recommended that he go to the Further Education College in Black Rock, where I chair the board, where they have a business PLC. He did that. He got a distinction in each of his 8 modules, and his mum was on to me this morning. He has his offer in Commerce and UCD this morning in his fist, and he is as happy, you know, as whatever.
Yeah, there's so always options is the main message, isn't it?
For students who don't get that place this year, there is always the post-Leaving Cert option. For other students, there is the problem this year that obviously because the minister has given the guarantee, which he probably had to, for this year's students, that the results would be no less good than they were in 2021, obviously, the points are going to be quite high, as they were last year, because if everybody gets super results, then obviously the point for the entry requirements will rise accordingly. The reason that was done is that there are 10,000 to 12,000 students in the competition for the 8th of September competition who did the Leaving Cert last year, who have very high results, and for the previous year, which had higher results than 2019. So effectively, you have this body of people every single year who are applying for places on the CAO who are coming from a previous year's Leaving Cert. The only problem with what she's done, and she had to do it, was what does that now do for the students going to sixth year this year? Because, you know, the exams this year were modified. They were made easier because of, obviously, the time a lot of these students lost to COVID in fifth year. But now we're going to have a normal Leaving Cert in the coming year. These students have not lost any time. And effectively, we'll have 10 or 12,000 students next year who will be coming with the results from this year and from 2021 and 2020.
Oh God.
So how do you make a fair level playing field. But that'll be an issue you'll see bubbling up once we get back in September.
Absolutely, right. Well, I look forward to speaking about that issue with you in the next month or so. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. That is, of course, Brian Mooney. He's education columnist with the Irish Times and guidance counsellor. And the news, over 4,000 applicants received CAO round zero offers today. It's that time of year, believe it or not, again. A very different subject we are going on to now, co-sleeping. And I'm joined by child sleep consultant with Babogue Sleep. That is Erica Hargaden. How are you today? Oh, unfortunately, you should be there now, Erica. Sorry about that.
Oh, can you hear me now? No problem at all. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. So first thing, explain to me what co-sleeping is.
So co-sleeping is the choice or maybe the circumstance where parents might share their bed and their sleep environment with their children.
Okay, now is it a good, bad thing for parents to do this? Is it encouraged, discouraged? What's the overall view, I guess, by wider society on it?
The overall view for me would be that once parents and the child are happy in the circumstances that they're in, where the co-sleeping is happening, then sure, isn't that great? Everyone's happy. Now, in terms of its safety for small infants, under the American Academy of Pediatrics Safe Sleep Guidelines, co-sleeping would not be considered safe sleep. Now, parents do often choose to co-sleep with their infants, and there is, guidelines by the Lullaby Trust that help parents to choose to co-sleep safely, but it wouldn't be encouraged in the wider sleep consultancy industry.
Like, I'm reading an article here and the first line of it is sleeping like a baby is a well-worn phrase, but I've never understood that because, like, babies don't sleep that well.
Yeah, no, they can sleep well, but it is certainly a roller coaster to get them to that place. Between the ages of like newborn right up to 3 years of age, children will go through a wide range of sleep development in that time that actually will impact their sleep. So you might find that you've a newborn and they sleep quite well and they're, you know, maybe even some doing like 6 and 8 hour stretches at night, but then they will go through a developmental progression, which in turn will create a regression around sleep. So really, when you are a parent of a young child, you're going to go through many, many peaks and troughs and changes around your child's sleep.
And if you have decided, you know, to co-sleep with your child, whether that's from the age of 6 months or from, you know, toddler sort of age, when is it advised that you try and get out of it, if that makes sense? I know you're mentioning, you know, the American sleep, I can't remember the full name of
the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Pediatrics, yes.
There isn't a guideline as to when a parent might advised to stop.
How do you decide then when's the time for me to stop this?
When you're ready. So there may come circumstances that will dictate that the co-sleeping needs to come to an end. Maybe the child will choose that they no longer want to sleep in that manner and maybe they want to sleep independently. Maybe as a result of co-sleeping, parents are sleeping separately and they want to get back to sleeping in the same bed together and in turn they need their child to sleep independently. So really I would feel it is down to parental choice and also making sure that they're doing it in association with the child. Because the child, if they have been co-sleeping for a long period of time, it may be all they know around their circumstances with sleep. So any change to that needs to be taken slowly and surely with the child because they know nothing else.
Now, a lot of the time when we talk about items like this or issues like this, people refer to those who are well known, the celebrities, and they get kind of annoyed. But the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's an example of age and it's somebody we definitely know that does it. Alicia Silverstone, she's an actress. She played Cher in Clueless, if anybody did watch it. She still says that she co-sleeps with her son, who's 11 years old. Is there a right for people to be, I guess, inquisitive about that kind of age still sleeping with parents, or should that kind of be let go of, that judgment?
I think the judgment needs to be let go. Parenting is parenting and we're all going to parent slightly differently, and if we're to pass judgment on everybody who's a little bit different to us, then we're going to be passing judgment a lot, because we might be living on the same road as people we've lived around for 10 or 20 years, but if you put us all together, we will all have handled sleep, food and all the parenting things slightly differently. So I think people will naturally pass judgment when something is a little bit different, or they'll have a comment, or they'll have something to say about it. But really and truly, it's about family and parental and child happiness. And if that mum and that child and the whole family are happy and functioning well, well, isn't that what matters really?
Erica, just reading through a couple of articles about this issue, it brings me to a question which many people say that's not related at all, but I kind of think it is. People who are older and they're bad sleepers, in quotes, does that all stem from childhood having different sleep situations, or is that a bit, you know, too easy to put it off on that?
It's probably slightly too easy to put on it off on that. Now, I would definitely see correlations when I speak to different adults I come across. I don't practice in adult sleep, but I speak to parents and I ask them sometimes about their own sleep and how their own sleep was as children. And there can be correlations between maybe poor sleep as a child, not necessarily ever getting smoothed out as they went up into the adult stage. And sometimes it's a little bit about sleep hygiene and just making sure that they really, really prioritise their sleep. On the flip side, it could be something medical. It could be something else going on that's just never had the thumb put on it to really pinpoint why it's happening, that could have the adults not sleeping well. Or it could be a new thing, like anxiety can play a huge issue, you know, around sleep. You know, pressures around work and pressures around life changes. And there's a spate of different medical things that can cause poor sleep as well.
Okay, it's a very interesting topic. I think people have so many questions around sleep, whether it is sleep for a newborn, a two-year-old, or for a 42-year-old. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. That is, of course, Erica Hargadin, child sleep consultant with Babog Sleep. And Erica has a website for anybody who wants to get more information on it. It's babog.ie.